This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
This advertisement feature is paid and presented by Go Türkiye. Türkiye is a golfer's paradise, and much of that is down to Belek on the country's southern Mediterranean coast. Courses here cut through lush pine forest, set on fast, sandy ground that's kept in immaculate condition all year round. And for those never quite ready to call it a day, Belek is also host to the first full 18-hole floodlit course in Europe. Local pro Dennis Sutmaz is lucky enough to call Belek her training ground.
There are more than 15 courses. You can play golf in winter and summer.
And once the round is done, long lunches replace scorecards and spas, hammams and slow afternoons take over.
When I'm not playing golf, I usually go to the beach, tan, go into the sea. You just feel like you're in another world.
Because in Belek, luxury isn't about excess. It's about time well spent. Plan your next detour at goturkiye.com today.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parris. So, if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the place where the top experts take 28 minutes to fill you and me in on one of the big questions of the moment. You can subscribe to the podcast via BBC Sounds. It'd be really helpful if you tell us what you think by writing a review or rating us on your podcast provider. How can we improve otherwise? Our question today, should we be worried about the Chinese telecommunications giant Huawei? And if you enjoy this podcast, you might enjoy other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. We did quite a good one recently on the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative. This week, the boss of Huawei, the Chinese telecoms giant, said his company would never undertake any spying activities on behalf of the Chinese state. But a security policy think tank warned that allowing Huawei to participate in Britain's 5G network would be naive and irresponsible. Last autumn, the United States sent a delegation to Europe to make much the same point. So this week we're asking, how worried should we be about Huawei? Step inside the briefing room to find out. Huawei, which means splendid act or China is able in Mandarin, isn't quite a household name here in the UK, at least not yet. So we've asked the economist Dr. Linda Yu and Wan Yuan Song, a BBC journalist from China, to give us a beginner's guide to the company and how it got to be so big so fast.
Huawei was founded by Ren Zhengfei in 1987. Ren Zhengfei was an entrepreneur with a small amount of money, as the story goes. He set up Huawei in Shenzhen, which is just across the border from Hong Kong. So early on, Huawei was selling imported telecoms equipment that it was buying from Hong Kong, bringing it across the border and selling it into mainland China. The equipment is the infrastructure that allows for telecommunications, whether it's mobile services or other ways of data transfer. So they're an equipment provider. They didn't start producing mobile phones until actually much later on. At one point, Huawei stopped just being an importer of telecoms equipment and started adapting the telecoms equipment for the Chinese market. Now, remember, China in the 1990s was still a relatively poor country. So the equipment that Huawei was selling into China was also very much in demand by other emerging economies, which needed telecoms infrastructure, but obviously the cheaper it is, the more affordable it is. And so in the 90s and 2000s saw Huawei expand domestically and globally, and in the 2010s, they became a global brand on the back of entering into the consumer market, smartphones. Huawei is a private startup, it's a private company, but to operate in China, you will have to deal a lot with the Chinese government, especially in the era in which Huawei has started operating, which is the 1980s, when China was just beginning to open. And of course, more recently, the Chinese Communist Party has placed representatives on the boards of even privately held companies. They invest about 10% of their revenues into research and development. They're working on cutting-edge technologies like AI, simultaneous translators. And when they moved into the consumer market, they started producing mobile phones, smartphones, not because the technology is very sophisticated, but because they wanted to become a global brand. So now they're about the second or third biggest smartphone maker in the world, and they're the only Chinese company to be included in Interbrand's top 100 global brands.
So a few years ago, when I came back to my hometown, the Apple store was very crowded and popular. Holding an Apple phone, showing you are a trending and a popular young person. But nowadays, Apple store were almost deserted on China streets, and Huawei became very popular. When I was back earlier this month, my cousin told me, no one buys Apple now because we all support the domestic brands. So we all support Huawei. In the time that China is really growing fast and the people are much more proud of China than ever, the young generation, supporting Huawei has become something they believe is an act of supporting the country and expressing they're proud of what China has achieved so far. So when people see the name, China is able, it's more likely to make them feel, oh, there is something I can do for this country. My mom, she is holding a Huawei phone. She went to North China for the winter. It was really cold down there. And iPhone, Samsung, none of those foreign phones worked over there. Only her Huawei phone could take pictures. So that's something made them believe the Chinese brand is really both cheap and have good quality. So why not?
Huawei is modeled after Silicon Valley, and when I visited their campus in Shenzhen, I found that people describe themselves as Huawei-ren. So it's like being a Googler, they're Huawei person. So young graduates think it's very prestigious to work for Huawei, it's very competitive to be hired, and it has this feeling of being a cutting-edge tech company, which is quite appealing to a lot of graduates.
So Ren Zhengfei has a background of the serving for the military. And although Huawei claimed they have never seen Ren holding a military rank, but he remained on the civil side of the military. But Ren has acted as the director of the military's Information Engineering Academy. Chinese people view him more as a national hero. His image is a humble man who would even go to take the tube himself. His image is a great father and a great hero that helps China to leading the world technology.
Thanks to Linda Yu and Wan Yuan Song for that explainer. Now, the smartphones Huawei makes are not the big problem. To explain what is, I'm joined from Berlin by Peter Kleinhans, a leading cybersecurity expert. Peter Kleinhans, Huawei aren't just about handsets, are they?
Exactly. So the discussion that we have right now is actually not at all about the security of smartphones or tablets. But what we are worried about and what everybody is discussing is actually the entirety of the telecommunication networks. So the antennas, the mobile base stations that you see on almost every roof nowadays that connect to your smartphone and that ensure that the data that is sent out from your smartphone is then received by this antenna, and then all the data from this antenna through the base station is then fed into the network from the telecommunication operator. And for this type of network, mobile network equipment, Huawei is actually the world market leader with a 29% market share worldwide.
So if I look out of my window, I'm going to see something belonging to Huawei.
Quite certainly, yeah. All of the stuff that you see out there is actually just from a handful of manufacturers. There are just five manufacturers worldwide.
So what can 5G do that 4G, 3G, 2G couldn't?
The big difference with 5G is that it's not about human-to-human communication anymore, but it's about massive machine-to-machine communication. So the hundreds of thousands of sensor networks that run a smart city or that run a smart factory or that are next to the road and under the bridges to enable autonomous cars. And this has not been possible with 2, 3, or 4G. And this is why now governments and also agencies are worried about the security and trustworthiness of 5G networks, simply because the stakes are higher if your entire economy will depend on the resilience of this future infrastructure.
With regard to this, why are people worried about Huawei and the Chinese specifically rather than the other manufacturers?
The reason why we talk about this is that we don't have any mechanism to prove the absence of malicious software. So at the end of the day, you always have to trust the manufacturer to keep a network device secure or any piece of software secure, to fix vulnerabilities and to not exploit weaknesses in the system. The extent to which you trust the manufacturer also depends on the country and the legal system in which this manufacturer operates in. So that means from a European perspective, we would trust Ericsson and Nokia more to do their job in our best interest than Huawei and ZTE, not because we don't trust the companies, but we don't trust the Chinese legal and regulatory system.
Peter Kleinhans. So 5G could give Huawei access to massive amounts of UK data, but could that data end up with the Chinese government? Professor Steve Tsang is director of the China Institute at the School of Oriental and African Studies. Steve Tsang, how would you describe the relationship between Huawei and the Chinese government?
Well, Huawei is, if you like, a kind of national champion, one of those companies that the Chinese government prize as being top-notch, world-competitive companies. But I think Huawei is also a company that is not just an ordinary national champion, but one that enjoys a special place in the eyes of the Chinese government.
So what would the government possibly do for it or with it that it wouldn't do for another company?
Well, we have already seen what the government would do for Huawei. When its chief financial officer and the daughter of the founder of Huawei was arrested in Vancouver, Canada, at the request of the United States for alleged fraud, the Chinese government detained two Canadians in China, have not yet charged them, and the Chinese ambassador to Canada actually said that those arrests were self-defense acts on the part of China, and that really kind of confirms that Huawei enjoys a very special place in the eyes of the Chinese leadership.
How does Huawei itself like to describe the relationship it has with government?
Well, Huawei describes itself as a completely private, entrepreneurial, enterprising and innovative company that does not do anything on behalf of the Chinese government or the Chinese Communist Party. Huawei's founder has actually said that if Huawei were asked by the Chinese government to spy on others, then he will close Huawei down.
So let's step back from Huawei a moment and look at the system a little bit. How easy is it to grow a company in China and keep your distances from the organs of the Chinese state, the various agencies?
It's very easy to grow a company in China into a modest size. But to grow a company to be as big as Huawei in a very sensitive, technologically innovative area, it is a very different story. Because the IT infrastructure in China itself would be handed potentially to a company like Huawei, and there is huge national security implications for the Chinese government. There is no way the Chinese government will allow that to be handed over to a company that the party does not trust 100%.
Now, let's cut to the chase here. Is there actually any evidence that Huawei has passed information to the Chinese government or the security services?
Now, we have no evidence that we have found of Huawei operating in a European or North American context, passing information back to the Chinese authorities. The only case that we know happens in the African Union building in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. The Chinese government provided the money and the Chinese company building, and Huawei provides the IT infrastructure for that building. When that building came into operation from 2012 to 2017, for 5 years, at night, there were a lot of traffic that transfer data from the IT systems in the headquarters of the African Union back to a destination in China.
Do we know what the content of that traffic was?
Now, we do not know what the contents of those traffic were. The African Union did raise the issue with the Chinese government in a very low-key manner, and they have since, as I understand it, removed the bulk of those problematic IT infrastructure to secure their own IT system. But for 5 years, massive amount of data were transferred from the African Union headquarters to a destination in China.
Now, we've heard that people are worried about letting Huawei get involved with Britain's 5G infrastructure. But let's think a moment about the possible benefits of having that relationship.
Well, it certainly will happen sooner and cheaper if we use the 5G technology from Huawei than if we use the more expensive European alternatives. But here we are looking at a technology, 5G, that if it lives up to its reputation, will be used by our defense forces in future operations. We will never consider asking Chinese shipyards to build our next generation's destroyers or frigates, even though they can build them much more cheaply than we can build them in British shipyards. So why do we want to hand over a major national security-related infrastructure to a government, to a country which does not share our basic values?
Professor Steve Tsang. 5G is a big deal then. It has all kinds of applications, including, as we've just heard, ones with big security implications. How are we in Britain assessing those implications, and what should we decide to do about them? To discuss this, I'm joined by Charlie Parton, a senior associate fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, and he's also author of the report I mentioned at the beginning. With me too is Dr. Tim Stevens, lecturer in global security at King's College London, and joining us on the line from Dubai is Emily Taylor, editor of Chatham House's Journal of Cyber Policy. Charlie Parton, your report said allowing Huawei's participation is at best naive, at worst irresponsible. Can you give us a summary of why you say that?
I'm worried that because there is a technological risk, at the moment our relations with China are fine and one hopes that they improve, but there are great differences between us, and China has not been reticent at using pressure and threats and bullying on a whole variety of countries. This gives a very powerful weapon to a strategic and possibly hostile power. And it's more than that. It's the fear that it induces that, oh, well, we better not do this because ultimately a lot of our critical national infrastructure is dependent upon China, or they pay for a lot of it or whatever. I think that really does worry me.
And the second, so it's a fear of leverage.
It's a fear of it. And the second thing that worries me is the importance of adopting the same sense as our allies, because we are a member of the Five Eyes intelligence agreement.
Five Eyes being?
Being the United States, Australia, Canada and New Zealand.
These intelligence services.
This is a very important alliance for us in terms of our global stance and projection. And if we are seen as too weak a link in the chain, what might happen if the other allies say, I'm sorry, but we're not cooperating with you in terms of both the intelligence exchange and probably more importantly in the devising of methods to collect intelligence.
Emily Taylor, are you aware of evidence allegations made in other countries against Huawei?
Well, there's always been question marks about Huawei. So I think the ownership of Huawei has been a bit fuzzy. Nobody's really sure about the links or not to the Chinese government. And there's a general suspicion that any company that is able to thrive so much in the domestic environment in China surely must have links to the Chinese government. That's how the narrative goes. That said, the evidence of actual wrongdoing on the sort of state-sponsored front is lacking to date. Doesn't mean that there isn't activity going on. It's just there hasn't been that evidence. The recent indictments brought by the US government against Huawei about alleged breach of sanctions against Iran and stealing of trade secrets, those, if proven, are evidence of sharp practice or bad business practice. But what we don't have is that smoking gun and the link to the state.
Tim, what's the UK government's official position on the risk that Huawei might pose?
It's an interesting question. There is no official position as such on Huawei, nor is there any official security position yet on 5G, for example. But we've had two recent statements from elements of the UK government, both from the National Cybersecurity Centre, which is set up at the end of 2016 as part of the latest iteration of the National Cybersecurity Strategy. And we had Kieran Martin, the CEO of NCSC, saying, you know, whatever risk exists in the case of Huawei, we can manage it. And one of the cases he used to support that is since 2010, we've actually had a special cell in Banbury in Oxfordshire called the HCSEC, the Huawei Cybersecurity Evaluation Centre, which is set up specifically between Huawei and GCHQ to audit, test and verify that there isn't anything untoward going on with the Huawei kit. Now, that reports every year. It's due to report again this year. Should be a very interesting report to read indeed. But the last report said that there were indeed engineering problems with Huawei kit. There were issues with the supply chain, which in all these information technologies is very, very long. And when it reaches deep into China, you can't always validate and assure the security of those components. After that statement by Kieran Martin, we had an additional statement by Ian Levy, who's the chief technical officer of NCSC, who's doubling down rather on this and saying that, you know, those serious engineering issues have not been addressed by Huawei. And that's where the risk comes from.
Right. I'm getting mixed signals out of all that. Charlie Parton, the most important aspect of that is, it seems to me, is the confidence that the UK government initially seems to suggest it feels that in managing the risk. Now, why would they say that if they weren't fairly convinced?
We shall see what the decision is and the degree of that confidence. But in terms of why I lack confidence in it and why, for instance, the Australians have lacked confidence in it, this is their head equivalent of GCHQ, similar with NSA. A large factor in it is some of the new Chinese national security laws, where clauses lay out very clearly that whether you're an individual or an organisation, if the intelligence services of China request you to do something, you are by law required to do that.
How involved is Huawei in UK infrastructure already? Emily Taylor.
Huawei has been involved in the UK for the last 18 years and has been providing key communications infrastructure to BT since about 2004, 2005. Over the last 5 years, it's invested $2 billion in the UK and is responsible for 7,500 direct and indirect jobs. It has just recently pledged another, I think, $2 or $3 billion, there are conflicting reports, over the next 5 years. And when we're looking at the sounds from British government and intelligence, there's a real change in tone in the last couple of months. moving from caution to a sense that this is a risk that can be managed.
Which suggests that we're caught between, if you like, a kind of slightly sunnier assessment of the risk and their desire not to fall out with our intelligence cooperators in other countries. How much greater is China's power to force companies like Huawei to hand over information than, let's say, the UK's is?
There are recent domestic laws in China requiring providers, and particularly providers of critical communications infrastructure, to cooperate with domestic intelligence services. The language is quite widely drawn, and so it's easy to imagine that it could be flexibly interpreted, shall we put it like that. At the same time, the UK itself has recently enacted very wide-ranging surveillance laws, which also require domestic providers to cooperate and to share data and to also lift encryption protections and disclose internet connection records. Now, the big difference, I would suppose, is that this all in the UK is created within a context of checks and balances, oversight and human rights protections, which perhaps wouldn't be the same situation as in China.
You don't mean perhaps, do you?
I don't mean perhaps. No, I don't. However, one thing that the Chinese authorities are able to do is point to our domestic laws and draw similarities between the two.
That's interesting. It doesn't help the British government resolve its dilemma in a way.
It doesn't. And I think that the dilemma is particularly acute at this time when Huawei is there intending to make very significant investments in the UK just at a point where we're leaving the EU and many other foreign investors are leaving, particularly in the automobile industry.
Tim Stevens, what is the history of Chinese government espionage, industrial espionage and others, which has been linked to the UK and the US?
Yes, it's a long and inglorious one. It's important to understand that when I'm answering this question, I'm not talking about Huawei, but we are talking about a context in which China sees commercial cyber espionage as a tool for reducing the technology gap with the United States and ultimately drawing level with it and in the end becoming more powerful than it in the technology space. And in the early 2010s, estimates about the amount of intellectual property that were being siphoned off from the United States, just the United States, to China was somewhere in the region of about $300 billion a year. And very famously, the former head of the NSA, General Keith Alexander.
The National Security Agency.
Yes, the National Security Agency. He said this was the greatest transfer of wealth in human history.
So what kind of thing was nicked, to put it?
A very famous case was with the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter. And again, these are all alleged. It's very difficult to prove anything in this space. The F-35, US-UK mainly project, was the most expensive weapons system in history. And if true, a lot of commercial data was stolen from companies like Lockheed Martin. So key actors in what's called the defense industrial base, international global players, as far back as 2007. And the allegation is that a lot of that intellectual property was transferred into the Chinese aerospace and defense sector and then translated into plans, for example, for their own stealth fighters like the J-20 and the J-31. And there are remarkable similarities between them if you ask military analysts.
Charles Parton.
And in a UK context, I think Mr. Dyson was rather upset at the theft of some of his designs.
Emily Taylor.
I don't know if Tim would agree on this, but it seems like there's been quite a shift in strategy in recent years, and particularly within Huawei, where we see a huge investment in research and development. Their latest annual report says that 80,000 employees are engaged in research and development. And so there seems to be a real step change. It's not to say that the alleged industrial espionage has gone away, but that there seems to be a major investment and a change in emphasis to create new domestically, to be innovators in ways that perhaps wasn't done before.
So, Tim Stevens, what is the worst thing that could happen with our 5G system and Huawei?
I think we have to be very careful when we're thinking about worst-case scenarios in respect of cybersecurity. Cybersecurity has been a field in which conventionally the worst-case scenarios have often ruled the roost. And when it comes to thinking about the interdependencies of critical infrastructure, for example, so energy, food, transport, communications, civil nuclear, and so forth, all of those are contingent in some on to some degree on information technologies like the internet, like the sort of communications networks we're discussing today. And the worst case scenario is run something like this. An external body hacks into those networks, brings down air traffic control, planes fall from the sky, chemical plants explode, trains derail, the traffic lights stop, food delivery ends, the lights in the hospitals go off. And people die. That's not really the kinds of worst-case scenarios we're talking about here. The worst-case scenario, if you're a politician right now or a strategic planner, is actually ceding strategic advantage to the Chinese and giving them leverage over various government infrastructure, over potentially military and intelligence, and ultimately at a societal level about if China is calling the shots, as it were, pulling various levers that it's derived from intelligence and surveillance in the UK. That's not a position you want to be in as a leading global power.
Charlie Parton there with Tim Stevens and Emily Taylor. And my thanks also to Linda Yu, Wen Yuan Song, Peter Kleinhans and Steve Tsang. And where does that leave us? Well, there's certainly a risk attached to Huawei's involvement in UK 5G. And it's a risk that the government seems inclined to take at the moment. But they could be wrong. That's all from us. We'll be back for a new series in the spring. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The series producer was Helen Grady. The producers were Siobhan O'Connell and Kirstine Knight. The editor was Jasper Corbett. And the production coordinator was Ike Egbertola. And if you'd like to listen to more episodes, you can catch up by going to BBC Sounds. We have quite a library.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So, if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.